Hello, welcome to Batman Nightcast, one of thousands of Batman podcasts, but guaranteed to be the only one co-hosted by me, Chris Franklin.
And me, Ryan Daly.
And we're back to discuss the second part of the Hot House story arc by John Francis Moore and P. Craig Russell from Legends of the Dark Knight, and also Batman and Robin Year One Number 5 by Mark Waid and Chris Samnee. But first, any Bat news we'd like to discuss, Ryan?
Not that I'm aware of, but I'm sure you've got something in our notes.
Yeah. Just a little bit. Mattel released the first image of their play line of upcoming DC figures that are set to come out later this year. Among those, there was like a John Stewart Green Lantern and two Batman and a Superman and I think a Deathstroke and a Joker and a Flash. But the Robin figure they showed I thought was interesting because he's more or less based on Dan Mora's redesign of Dick Grayson's classic costume that we covered here when we talked about Waid and Mora's Superman Batman or Batman Superman World's Finest series. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with that outfit. I think we talked about it, like that was a really good costume redesign. It was true to the spirit of the original with a little bit of a modern update. The pants,
right?
but yeah, that was cool. So I think if they're making an action figure based on that design, now that's telling. That's something important.
Yeah, I'm glad to see they're actually like, you know, it's not. I've heard some people say the figures look a little like older figures, but these are the playline figures. They're not the collector line. They're not meant to, although apparently they are 6-inch scale and they do say new legends will rise. So people are thinking, oh, are they trying to say these are Marvel Legends-esque figures? But I don't know. Or people are speculating they're 6 inches tall. I don't know if anybody said, but we'll find out what they're doing. As far as collector stuff go, probably not till later this year, maybe at Toy Fair next week, but as we record this, but probably, or this weekend actually, but probably I'd say maybe San Diego Comic Con because McFarlane still got the license through the rest of the year for the collector stuff. And with their, Masters of the Universe movie figures, apparently they're going 6-inch, not the 7-inch like they had done with the Masterverse figures. So maybe we're going to see all the DC lines being 6-inch. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
I think for a lot of collectors, they want it. I mean, they like that kind of universal scale. It looks good to have them kind of on the same display. And
yeah,
of course, if you want to do some sort of photography of, you know, Marvel versus DC or those type of things, then it helps to have them in the same size, the same kind of scale.
Right. And I always thought it was kind of weird that McFarlane went 7 inches instead of 6, but, you know.
Because he's extreme, damn it. He's got to do everything different.
It's like when DC directed those costume collector figures like 20 years ago and they made them 13 inches tall instead of 12. I'm like, what were you thinking? I mean, they don't fit in with anything now. You know, it's...
But didn't we talk about during Batman Year 2 that Todd McFarlane's grasp of anatomy and scale and proportion is a little bit not exactly what, you know, we hold to with
great
Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, proportions?
Right, exactly. He's not paying attention to the style guide, that's for sure. Yeah, you're right. So, yeah, we shouldn't be surprised. As far as other rumors, I just saw, and this might be one of those just... there's absolutely nothing to it. I think Cindy showed it come across her phone that the rumor that Marvel is eyeballing Robert Pattinson to play Ghost Rider in a film. I don't know if I would imagine that they have the big stars of their movies like locked down that they can't cross the streams like that. I would bet. I could be wrong, but I know we got Sebastian Stan and ScarJo coming over to the Batman. But, you know, after, you know, ScarJo's probably done anyway. And I've, you know, maybe Sebastian Stan's time in the MCU is over as you know, when Doomsday and Secret Wars is done. So I don't know, but it could be absolutely nothing to it. So do not take this to the bank. It might just be some fan casting that managed to go slightly viral, but, I have no idea. So
I hadn't even heard about it. That I had no idea that they were even thinking about another Ghost Rider project. I'm intrigued because I've always liked the character. I've always liked the idea of the character. I would like to see what type of Ghost Rider they go with. Is it the Johnny Blaze or Danny Ketch? Obviously, they had the more recent one in the TV show, the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. TV show for a little while. That was the Jaime one with the Hell Charger.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I don't know. I've heard rumors that they've scrapped the Blade movie, but Mahershala Ali will still be Blade in a Midnight Suns movie, so maybe that's where Ghost Rider's going to come in.
Okay, that could be.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, but we'll see.
And they'll certainly want to bring back Jared Leto's Morbius because of how many people loved that. You know, that's a fan favorite.
They'll re-release it in theaters again because they think that there's a demand for it. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they've got Moon Knight and Werewolf by Night and Man-Thing in the wings if they wanted to do like a monster.
Yeah, Legion of Monsters type thing. Yeah. I'm really like, why haven't they done more with Werewolf by Night? That's so great. I mean, we talked about that on the podcast, you, me, Cindy, and Neil, and it's like, why haven't they done more with that? That was one of the best things Marvel's done in the last several years. Although I really did like Wonder Man, that was a really.
I haven't watched that yet, but everywhere I turn, people are like, this is amazing, you need to see it. And even if you're not a Marvel fan anymore, or you're burnt out.
Yeah.
Like, this is one worth watching. So, all right, I'll give it a shot, but I haven't yet.
Yeah, it's really great. It's really great. And, I was really just, I had no expectations going in other than it looked a little quirky and kind of fun and different. It's the you know, both leads were fantastic in it, and it's a great story. And if you could totally remove the Marvel part, and it would still be a good story. So, you know, it's really good. So, but we probably ought to talk about DC stuff, particularly Batman, don't you think?
Probably. I mean, I hate to get flagged with false advertising.
Well, you've got the first comic this time, so I'll hand the mic to you.
All right, we are going back to Batman Legends of the Dark Knight with issue 43. This one had a cover date of March 1993 with an on-sale date of February 16th of that year. The cover by P. Craig Russell shows a dark, almost inhuman take on Poison Ivy, with her hair and dress sprouting/creeping like vines. Or ivy, I guess. Ivy's primary color in the image is green, naturally, over a red background with red-colored bats lining the edges of the cover. What do you think about this one, Chris?
I think it's a great cover, and I was really shocked that, surprisingly, this version of Poison Ivy actually appears in the comic. So,
Yeah. Despite the fact that she's all blacked out and looks sort of monstrous, almost, I mean, I'm kind of getting almost a Medusa-esque vibe just because of the way her... The hair is kind of like, you can almost replace those with snakes, and there's a little bit of a...
Yeah, and it's kind of weird. It's almost like the drapery that's around her is almost making a question mark, so it's almost like you expect the Riddler to show up maybe in this. Yeah, I really like it. I love P. Craig Russell's bats. They just look... Mm-hmm. They look great. They're kind of Mike Mignola-esque, you know. Yeah.
I have the same note. It kind of reminds me of it, especially when you put the two covers together. And that's the other thing. I think, like, these covers, the cover for 42, which I liked, and the cover for this one, which I like, but when you put them side by side, it's like the sum is greater than, or the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, or something like that.
Right.
Whatever you're trying to say. Like, the two of them together make it exponentially better because you see the contrast in colors, whereas the previous one, it was all green background playing with the ivy theme and the leaves and the foliage on the sides, kind of in the border, whereas Batman with his weird wings was kind of shaded and colored in red. This one, it's flipped, all red background, red bats along the side with ivy being green. And seeing that juxtaposition, I really think that they're two parts of the same piece, and it's kind of a very fun contrast. I like it.
Nice, nice. And I did not read in the notes that you have Mignola-esque in here. I did not mean to steal your comment. I am sorry.
I had nothing other than just Mignola. I mean, yeah, you said I wasn't going to like say more than that. You got it. Yeah. Getting into the story, Hot House Part 2 is written by John Francis Moore with art by P. Craig Russell. It's lettered by Bill Pearson, colored by Laverne Kinzierski, and edited by Archie Goodwin. Dominique Alioso is released on bail and attacks Pamela Isley on the steps of the courthouse, believing, correctly, that Pam ratted the Eden Spring operation to Batman. Captain Gordon steps in to protect Pamela and is quickly charmed by her presence. Later, while meeting with Batman, Gordon speculates that Pamela's poison ivy powers may be back, and she might have manipulated the suicide of Ian Spencer. Batman is hurt, offended even, that Gordon would slander an amazing woman like Pamela Isley with baseless accusations. He storms off to continue the investigation without Gordon, but when the autopsy reveals that Spencer was dying from a fungal poisoning before his suicide, Batman can't shake his doubts about Pamela's innocence. Later still, while stopping a robbery, Batman hallucinates one of the robbers is Pam. The return of Poison Ivy is no longer in doubt. Batman flies to Seattle to question one of Pam's college classmates. Professor Sylvian recounts how he met Pamela Isley, how she eventually fell in love with Jason Woodrue, who experimented on her, granting her abilities, and Poison Ivy's first murder victim. The professor gives Batman a gel to protect his skin from her touch. Dominique's partner, Victor, goes to the greenhouse to kill Pamela, but she takes control of him. She's found a new dealer to push Eden Spring for her, but Batman arrives and clocks that guy. When Poison Ivy fails to influence Batman, she confesses to murdering Ian Spencer. Then she sicks Victor, her new love slave, against the Dark Knight. They fight, and Batman defeats him, naturally. However, during the scuffle, the gel protecting Batman from Ivy's pheromones rubs off, and she kisses him. The touch sends Batman into a trippy, near-catatonic state. Poison Ivy says she still loves Batman, she always has, and is about to remove his mask. In desperation, Batman lashes out, activating the sprinkler system in the greenhouse. Poison Ivy forgets about Batman long enough to protect her plants. It's just enough time for her spell to wear off him. Distraught that her true love has rejected her again, Poison Ivy almost kills herself, but Batman saves her, and she's sent back to Arkham Asylum, where she tells anyone who will listen that Batman is in love with her. All right, big picture overall thoughts on this one?
I really enjoyed it. It took some twists that I really didn't expect, honestly. I mean, I knew Batman would have to confront the fact that he was definitely being influenced by Pamela here, but I didn't kind of expect the characterization of Poison Ivy we got. So, you know, it was kind of a refreshing take on her in a lot of ways. I mean, in some ways she kind of was the victim that Batman said she was, but she also was also manipulating people herself. There was a lot of manipulation going on in the story. Everyone was manipulating everyone.
Yeah, I loved this two-parter so much until like the last three pages when we get the turn from her as kind of this love obsessive with Batman, and when she can't have him, she can't control him, she's like thinking about committing suicide, and I'm like, this is kind of undoing a lot of what they built up for her character to have, like this kind of this long game, consider like revenge scheme of poisoning these guys and taking back control of her life and things like that. And I just thought they were doing a lot. And then the reversal at the end was just kind of making her psycho chick who's boy crazy. I'm like, I wish you hadn't done that. There are big emotions kind of going on in the last pages. So the sort of heightened tension of it kind of makes it a little bit more palatable, but I still would rather they not have done this to her character for the last two pages after they had clearly been taking her a different direction.
Yeah, I kind of get too that they'd really just want to say that even in the universe of Batman, she really is like unbalanced. You know, she's really psychotic. Like she might exude control for a while, but really if the slightest thing goes awry, then she reverts to this state of, you know, she's either ready to kill herself or she's, you know, tra-la-la-la-la, you know, he loves me not, that type thing, you know, which we get at the end. So it's, I kind of get what they're getting with that, but at the same time, it's especially nowadays, it's kind of, it's very different than the Poison Ivy we kind of expect nowadays, where she's a super strong, very, you know, self-reliant, very independent character that's, you know, doesn't even want to deal with men, you know, so being obsessed with Batman's kind of weird nowadays in the context of what you expect out of a Poison Ivy story, so.
And yeah, there's also, I mean, comic books, superhero comic books have a track record of making really powerful female characters go crazy. Jean Grey with the Phoenix, Scarlet Witch going nuts, Invisible Woman when she gets, you know, possessed by a mouse. These aren't just John Byrne's hang-ups. We also see that, you know, here, like, you know.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Good point. Yeah, yeah.
Although it does make you think about John Byrne and what he's got going
on. Right, yeah. He was really, yeah, really kind of bad about that, yeah.
getting into the issue itself, yeah, we have this scene in the beginning, which... I found this a little bit like this must be after the arraignment and Dominique is talking to her lawyers, but the fact that Pam is there too, it seems a little bit like, I'm not sure what exactly the proceedings were before this scene.
Yeah. It's like, are they walking? It looks like they're walking out of the courthouse at the same time. It's like, you think the lawyers would be smart enough to not have them walk out side by side.
Right. Yeah.
Because she is not, Dominique is not subtle here. I mean, you know, I mean, she goes lying tramp and, you know, and she's like, I'm going to get you for this. You know, I mean, she's just, you're going to regret crossing me, Isley. You know, I mean, she's just, you know, and then she, you know, says, I want that woman dead, Victor, dead. And I mean, you know, she's barely stepped away from Gordon and Isley at this point. You know, I mean, it's, again, you know, Jill Thompson, calm down. That's all. Yeah.
What did you think of Gordon's suit?
Did he borrow it from Harvey Dent? I mean, it looks like the old orange side of Harvey Dent's suit, you know, in the old comics when it would, you know, that's what it looks like. But he's got the whole suit. It's like, you know, did he leave it hanging in his closet one day? And Gordon was like, eh, you know, he's not coming back for this. And, you know, I don't, he's got the matching pants, too. Yeah, it's and it's got that, you know, only in comics thing where Russell just draws a grid and it's just a straight grid across his shape. It doesn't follow the arms or the, I kind of like when they do that. It's kind of a nice graphical touch, but it's also kind of weird. Of course, you know, Russell's art's very avant-garde in a lot of ways for comic art. You know, the way he does Ivy's hair or Pamela's hair and things like that. She's always got these horizontal lines going across her hair that, instead of showing like all the curls and everything like that, he's got a very unique style.
And of course, throughout this whole thing, Gordon was across from the courthouse buying flowers for his wife, and then the flowers get knocked down, and Ivy stops to help him pick them up, and she's like, "Oh, who's the lucky lady?" And you see, he's completely ensorcelled; he can't even remember his wife's name. And then we cut to him talking to Batman, and Gordon is the one who, you know, when I saw her, you know, I start talking to her, couldn't even remember my wife's name. I was like, are you sure, Batman? She doesn't have her powers. And how does Batman react to this?
I love it. I will reenact this. Let's see. You think I didn't check the medical records? You think I wouldn't know if she still had her Ivy touch? You think I'd let her manipulate me again? It's like, and Gordon's got this question mark face. Well, anyway, I've had the Spencer autopsy in the morning. You know, it's just like.
It is the classic telling on yourself by overreacting too much.
Yeah.
It's like, don't I look relaxed? What are you talking about? It's like,
right. Yeah. It's like the whole when your friends are like, hey, man, you know that girl you've been dating? She's not really good for you. And you're like, you shut up about her. You know,
And yeah, just like Gordon's reaction, just that question mark. He's like, okay, Batman's going through some stuff.
Right, yeah. I love Pamela, and she's great. And we're going to get married and have kids and buy a house. Shut up. You know?
The results from about Spencer, who died in the last issue, and finds out that the guy was going to die soon if he hadn't committed suicide anyway because he had fungal poisoning. And it's like, that's kind of odd and fairly rare and a little bit, you know, weird to have a connection to fungus and a woman who's all plant-like.
So. Mm-hmm. Red flag, Batman. Yes. I do like that Batman. I like that Batman's very conversational in this story. He talks to the mortician. You know, he talks to the lady working at the morgue. He talks to the professor later. He's a much more conversational, like we said, a little bit more of a Bronze Age-y Batman than the Batman we normally see in Legends of the Dark Knight. That's more like the modern, you know, year one Frank Miller-esque Batman. Right. So
yeah. Back to the greenhouse, we see Ivy is talking to her new drug dealer, new guy on the street, because she is kind of working outside of Dominique Elioso and her operation now. So she gets, what is this guy's name again?
Evan Sachs.
How about him for a fashion example of 1993?
Oh, man, his shirt is so 90s. I mean, I think I may have had one like that at one point. I mean, it is, I'm pretty sure he got that at the Bugle Boy store, you know? I mean, that's how 90s it is. I mean, because he's got the like the pink with the black stripes on one side and then solid black on the other, but the sleeve on the other side also has the stripes, and then he's got the black pocket on the stripe side. So it's like, you know, and he's got shorts, he's got jorts on. So it is like, yeah, it is the 90s personified right there. Yeah.
like the split with the solid black and then the stripes, and like, okay, speaking of Two-Face, speaking of Harvey Dent, like, this is Gen X Two-Face coming out of a New Kids on the Block concert.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I love it. Yeah. Her drug dealer, Jordan Knight. You know, it's the only new kid I could think of. I know Donnie, obviously.
Donnie Wahlberg.
Yes, I know. Of course, him. Cindy was big in New Kids on the Block, and a girl I dated before Cindy was obsessed with New Kids on the Block. As like, I felt like I was competing with them when I was dating her, literally. Like, so this was a thing, you know. Yeah.
Ange actually saw New Kids on the Block in concert.
Oh, wow.
Recently, like 3 years ago.
Okay.
So
yeah.
It was New Kids on the Block. And she went for mostly the novelty of it, just to say, but it was New Kids on the Block with Salt-N-Pepa, En Vogue, and Rick Astley. Never Gonna Give You Up, Rick Astley.
Yeah. We're no strangers to love.
That was the vibe. It was like they were appealing to all of those, like the kids who were our age at that time. And yeah, she saw them. She was at a conference in Salt Lake City and went to see the concert there. And the best part is, she got COVID there.
Oh, God.
Yeah, COVID came back and gave it to all of us.
Oh, jeez.
Nice job. You got COVID because Donnie Wahlberg came up and serenaded you.
Brings whole new meaning to the New Kid song. Please don't go, girl. You know, I'm telling you, I know way too many New Kid songs. It's not because I'm a fan, guys. It's literally I was overexposed to it via the girls I dated, but
I was too. My brother may have had a summertime business doing a New Kids on the Block impersonation routine.
That's right.
With his friends.
I remember him talking about that on FW Records. Yes. Yeah, yes. Yeah, that's right.
I knew them very well. We had recorded a pay-per-view concert that they did, and a few of their songs still hold up. I'll cape for the song Tonight. That was a good song. I like that one.
Yeah, that is a good. It's kind of got a Beatles-esque kind of orchestral thing going on. Yeah, I joke. The New Kids are fine. I mean, they're actually fine, and they can sing. They're actually pretty talented guys. I shouldn't beat up on them. It's an old thing. Cindy actually kind of wanted to go see that same tour that you're talking about, and for whatever reason, and I was like, yeah, I'll. I'll, if In Vogue and Salt and Pepper are there, I'll go, you know, but I, you know, I can, and Rick Astley's fine, and I can deal with New Kids nowadays, but we didn't end up going for one reason or another, but yeah, I think they came to Lexington, and we thought about going, but
I asked her how many times Rick Astley did Never Gonna Give You Up, and she said just once, and I'm like, that's a wasted opportunity. You know the rules, and so do I. they could have Rickrolled everybody in the audience by doing that song more than once, and then having like Salt and Pepper come out, and they do that song too, and then everybody does the same song. That would have been like the greatest meta joke to play on an audience.
Take a strong, strong man to ever let that go. Yeah.
What a man.
Oh, man. Oh, are we still talking about Batman? What happened?
Are we? Okay, we got
more 90s music. I got to bring a reference up later, but I will later. But we'll bring another 90s artist here later. So,
Batman is stopping this robbery. These two kids on a motorcycle just do a smash and grab at a equivalent of a Circuit City or something. It's like Central Electronics or something. That's doing VCRs or something, I'm pretty sure. And Batman wraps a handcuff around one of them and then hangs him from like a pole, like an awning or something, like off the ground. I'm like, hanging by a handcuff like that? Like, That's going to mess up the hand, seriously. Like,
yeah, you might lose that hand eventually.
You might, like, depending on your body weight, that you could rip your hand right out of it.
Yeah, I mean, you could. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, yeah. And he sets the motorcycle on fire with, like, a stage magician trick that apparently looks worse than it is. But it's like, dude, you still set it on fire, you know? It's like
The robber who we found out is a woman is she's got nunchucks because again in the 90s,
right?
And he disarms her, finds out that it's a girl, and when he sees her, she looks just like Pamela. Yeah, we even get the image of her morphing into a extreme close up shot of her, maybe identical. It's either drawn remarkably similar to a panel from last issue, or it's the same one.
Yeah, yeah. I noticed that there's quite a bit of that in this issue, actually. Yeah, I don't know if he restatted stuff or he redrew it, but yeah, it's definitely that first close up when he first sees her in the crowd when Spencer kills himself. Yeah, and I like that Batman gets so mad at himself he punches the wall. Flack.
Yeah, and at this point, at least he has to admit it to himself. Like, what's been going on? He goes back to Alfred. They come out of the grandfather clock in the study as they usually do. What room is he walking through? Is this like I don't know if this is like a library or another family room in the Wayne Manor, but it's very pink and purple pastel colors. There's some kind of art hanging, but it's not on the wall. It looks like it's almost just kind of like on an easel or a stand or something. It's very,
it's like there's all these Legends of the Dark Knight are introducing these really strange rooms, like the toy room and Bruce Wayne still keeps. And now this room, it's like, you know,
like this seems like Martha's like sitting room or tea room or something like that.
Right.
It just hasn't changed in the 20 years since she died.
Yeah. And it very well could be. I mean, it could be that he just never changed it. I mean, my mom's been gone for 25 years and my dad never changed the living room because he rarely goes in there. So why would he change it? You know, we basically have Christmas in there and that's pretty much it. It's just the front room when you first come into the house and he's got no other thing. It's not that he's really like trying to preserve it. Like he's not deluded that my mom's coming back. It's just like, what am I going to do with it? So he just leaves it, you know? So it's like, that might be in this case, it might be like, that, you know, the house is so huge that it's like, just leave it. I don't have enough furniture to fill up that room. Just leave the furniture in there. You know, what's in there. And because it doesn't look like Bruce Wayne decorated this room. No.
Bruce gets on a plane and takes the Batman act on the road. He goes to Seattle, and at the moment I have to give a shout out to the new Super Bowl champion Seattle Seahawks, who just won last weekend as we're recording this. This is just in case Brett Young is listening to the podcast and wants a football reference. So there you go, Brett.
Yeah, go other birds. Yeah.
Yeah, go other birds. There you go. They're an avian species. They've got green in their uniform. It's kind of the same thing as his eagles.
Yeah. It's, you know, yeah. They're good on them. Yeah. And they won by quite a pretty good margin, too.
So. Quite a blowout. Quite an uninteresting game.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
And then, so he goes to Seattle to talk to these guys. And the house of Professor Sylvian, they even have it, the caption is, "The Cottage." This immediately made me think of the Mike Grell era of Green Arrow. Like, before he's going to name or kind of reference that. But I'm thinking of, like, Ollie and Dinah living ahead being Sherwood Florist and that whole kind of thing. Like, it's making me, is he going to see Ollie? Like, just calling the house a cottage and everything.
Yeah.
But I guess because it's kind of out in, like, the sticks or something, but it's like...
Yeah, I thought it was pretty interesting, yeah. And like you said, the name drop for... he says, except for the archer, the costume thing never caught on here. So it's like, Green Arrow reference, which back then was, you know, Green Arrow was supposed to be in Star City, so was Star City also in Washington State, or... I always kind of got it was out on the West Coast, but I don't know what... I can't remember what the DC Atlas says, where Star City's supposed to be. So,
I think it was Northern California.
Okay.
I think it was north of San Francisco.
Okay, well, that makes sense then. Yeah. But we get Jason Woodrue, and it's amazing how much of this storyline, mutated animal plant hybrids, how much of this storyline is also in Batman and Robin.
No kidding. I mean, they needed a little bit for her origin in the movie, and this was kind of the most recent, you know, contemporary thing.
Yeah.
Because I actually, after reading this one, I did go back and I was like, okay, we're kind of hinting back to her secret origin, which we talked a little bit about on the last episode. And I was like, what other appearances had she had in, like, the late 80s, early 90s, like, between that secret origin and this story? And I completely forgot that she was in the Suicide Squad, that original book, for, like, 12 issues or something like that, more like almost a year or two.
Right.
I need to go back, because I've read Suicide Squad 1 through, I think, 25, but I think that's the last issue of that I read. So I should go back at some point and finish up that whole era, the Ostrander run and everything, because I did like the book. I just need to get back to it, and especially because I'm curious, because I know Poison Ivy was there for a while, but I don't really know what part she had in it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, growing up, Poison Ivy, I remember there was a storyline, like in the early 80s, drawn by Irv Novik, where she almost took over the Wayne Foundation, because she had, like, everybody on the board under her control.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
And then there was a story right when Jason was, before he officially became Robin, but when he was Batman's partner wearing the really cool Don Newton Robin costume, and Don Newton drew it. And because I remember there's this one page in there where she has on a leaf bikini, not her usual outfit, and no tights. And I remember the way Don Newton and Alfredo Alcala drew her, I was like, I was only probably like 8 or 9, but I'm like, oh, I think I like girls. Yeah. You know? And actually, in that, I think that's the storyline right before Dick comes in and gives him the costume. Because when they're getting attacked by these plant men that she made, Batman calls out for Robin, and he, you know, Jason acts because he doesn't have a name at that point because Dick's still Robin. But
I looked at both of those issues when I was thinking I wanted to do a Poison Ivy story, and I looked at both of those stories that you just mentioned. I ended up choosing this one because I thought this one was a little bit more outside the box. This one would be a little bit more overlooked, and our trademark on this podcast is covering overlooked Dark Knight stories, so.
Yeah. Where have I heard that before?
It's ours. It's trademark.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. I like that Pete Craig Russell's Batman. I like the kind of the way he seems to be drawing a little bit different this one. His leathery effect, like that one page where Batman, it shows Batman's back, and right after the origin recap, the way he's doing the leathery texture on Batman's cape and cowl is pretty unique. But I kind of like it. It's a kind of a different look. I think partially because the blue underneath the black is pretty light.
Yeah.
But so it's a lot of contrast between that and the dark inks that he's putting in.
Yeah, it definitely looks more shiny and more reflective, which, again, maybe possibly influenced by the movie. But yeah, because when I first saw it, I was like, oh, it's just an effect of the rain. Because the page before that, when he's on the Professor Sylvian's porch, which is just, I mean, the natural reaction is like, Batman in Seattle? On my porch?
This is before the urban legend thing kicked in, which I know we've brought that up before. I hate that. I hate the urban legend thing.
But like definitely like the rain has an effect on his cape in that picture. But then yeah, the next one, like when, yeah, that close up of his back, it's really kind of interesting look. But and then yeah, we find out like how she probably killed her boyfriend and everything, and she's got all these like these new powers, and he's like, who knows what she's possibly capable of. And he compares her like almost like pheromone like effects to like a virus. The only way of preventing it is to like not be exposed to it. So he comes up with like he compares it to the kind of gel that firefighters wear to, or like stuntmen use to to not be burned in fire or something for fire effects for movies.
Yeah.
So I thought that was cool. And Batman's like, do you have any of this stuff? And he's like, I'm a college professor. I'm sure I can whip it up. It's like, oh, okay, what are you a professor of?
Yeah, exactly. I love how these guys always just have the right equipment in their house to mix up. I mean, you know, like if he, like, well, we'll have to go to the university and go to the lab, I might have it there. But no, this guy, what's this guy? Is this guy the Unabomber or something? Right. I mean, what's he, you know, what the hell's he doing in his spare time? You know, it's like at his house, you know.
Luckily, Batman, I taped last week's episode of MacGyver, and he has the exact same issue that he needs to invent. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I always think about it. That is always a spectacular stunt, though, when somebody just is on fire and walks through. Like, I rewatched Anchorman for the first time in a long time. during the rumble with the newscasters, some guy just walks by on fire, you know, and it's just like, that never gets old. I mean, it's just like so amazing. It's like, how do they do that and not die? You know, it's just like the scene in the first Nightmare on Elm Street when Freddy Krueger's chasing Nancy up the stairs and he's on fire. You know, it's like, it's insane. Yeah.
Then back in the greenhouse, Pam is whistling, I guess. That's what those symbols in the, in her, word balloons, I guess those musical notes, perhaps.
No. I guess, or she's talking to her plants in some weird, you know, Nell-like voice, or I don't know. I couldn't decide if she was whistling or that's just the way she, like, I mean, her plants don't react. And in this storyline, she doesn't control plants that, like, attack people. But, I guess she's whistling. But it is really, you know, it's not like actual musical notes. It's just these weird glyphs that appear.
So, Victor holds a very small gun up to her head, and, you know, she, of course, when he grabs her by the cheek, she has control over him as soon as he touches her. Then a little bit, we don't see how that it resolves right away, but we come back, and later on that night, our boy Evan, in a much more down-to-earth practical outfit, although still blazer with what appears to be just a plain white t-shirt, very of the time, too.
Yes.
Not as loud, but... He's getting the Eden Spring drug and can't help himself. He's a man. She's a woman. So he's got to start propositioning her and trying to take over the situation. And she's like, yeah, you don't know what you're doing. But before she can even possess him or sic Victor on him, Batman shows up and he threatens Batman. And one punch just clock right to the side of the jaw. And he is down.
Yeah. Shut up. I like that. And I just noticed he's got on shorts.
Yes.
His jacket. Yeah.
It must be a warm summer in Gotham this time. Like
that. Yeah, he is a fashion plate, that guy. I think that the fourth panel of Pamela's face looks like the first panel where Batman sees her in the crowd. from last issue.
It's
either he's drawn her the same way, or he's referencing that, or he lifted it, but it looks like the exact same image, which on the next page we get the close-up again.
Right, so. We get that lift again, yeah. And, yeah, he calls her Ivy, and she's, like, surprised by that, and she's like, oh, yeah, I'll always be Ivy for you. And, like, thinking that he's in love with her, and then she tries to possess him, but he's got the gel, so he's protected, and she, as soon as she can't manipulate him, she starts losing it. She says Ian Spencer had to die because he was a hypocrite, you know, he was cheating on his wife and dealing with all these criminals, and then basically anybody who violates her, anybody who takes advantage of her deserves to die, kind of going back to her original issues with Jason Woodrow, which I don't know why that never became a bigger thing in the comics, but...
Me neither, yeah. Yeah, it does make you wonder, like, if Ian hadn't, like, is she telling the truth here? Did Ian, like, was she going to try to go straight, and Ian basically took advantage of her criminal past and then got her involved with these criminals, and then when that happened, and she just figured, oh, to hell with it, I'm never going to get to go straight. Nobody's ever going to let me, so I'll just, if people want me to be Poison Ivy, I will be, you know, that type of thing.
As the Gen Z people would say, Victor is giving Zaz vibes in this one, because when we see him coming out, his shirt is off.
Yeah.
He's got plant fungus or something all over him, so not exactly scars, but similar idea, and a blade. And he's going all serial killer. I was like, looked at him, I was like, oh, that's the other Victor. Victor Zaz.
Right, yeah. I actually just finally watched the Birds of Prey movie that has a version of Victor Zaz. I never seen it, and it wasn't that bad. I thought it was fine. It was better than I thought it was going to be. So
the new 52 version of Count Vertigo is kind of like this. He's got like the Vertigo tattoos on his bare chest, I think. He just wears a cape over it, I think.
Almost sounds like the Tattooed Man.
a little bit. I'm trying to think. I think that was in the Green Arrow run by Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino. I think they introduced a new version of the Count Vertigo, who kind of had that look. It's a cool look.
Yeah, it is. It works. I mean, it makes you think of her, like her other stories where she's like possessed people via the plants, and you know, yeah.
Batman is kind of funny in the scene in his internal monologue, because when Victor first attacks him, he's like, nothing worse than big, stupid muscle, except big, stupid, hypnotized muscle. They tend to forget about the little things in life, like pain. And he's like, and he's got to be slugging Victor, and then Victor comes at him with the pruning shears, and he's like holding him down, and Batman has to like basically take a potted plant and smack him with it. He's like, I'm confronted by my own mortality on a nightly basis, but whenever, however, that final moment arrives, I'm damned if it'll be by gardening tools.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. Yeah, I'm surprised Pam didn't freak out when Batman, you know, killed that rose bush when he, you know, took it across his face. Because, you know, in the animated series, she always flips out when anybody hurts a plant, you know, so...
On that page, the bottom, the second to last panel, the penultimate panel, with him throwing the punch, throwing it forward, it's not exactly, there's something about the position of his body, like not with the fist up, but like I saw that panel and I was instantly reminded of, I don't know if you can picture it in your mind, but J.G. Jones has covered a Final Crisis, I think issue 6, that was the one where Darkseid actually blasted Batman with the Omega beams.
Yeah.
But like he's got a cover with J.G. Jones's covers for Final Crisis were interesting in that they all look like retro magazine covers, not what you would expect for a major line-wide universe shifting, you know, crossover. But then again, nothing about Final Crisis kind of seemed like that.
Yeah.
So it's just weird choice. But I don't know, something about that, like that. I see that picture and I'm reminded of J.G. Jones art and that kind of that style, that era.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting, because he's Batman. I mean, the cowl's details aren't drawn in, like the colorist colored the top of his cowl, and there's no bat symbol on his chest, although maybe it'd be covered by all the shadows. And His left arm looks really skinny. I know he's thinner, more lithe than most artists were drawing, but he kind of reminds me, you ever seen those photos that David Bowie's wife in the 70s wanted to play Black Widow, and she had a friend dress up as Daredevil?
Yeah.
It looks, and his costume was partially painted on. That's what it kind of looks like right here. It looks like that kind of some photo shoot where some model decided to kind of half-ass Batman. You know?
Yeah, yeah. That's it. I think part of it, maybe now that I'm looking, like, because of the two panels together, like, kind of, like, split, but the way, like, it almost looks like his left leg in the third-to-last panel when he's, like, arm cocked back, like he's going to throw the punch, when he's stepping forward with his left leg. It almost looked like that lines up to be his right leg on the panel beside it. So I think that's what's making him seem even skinnier.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. It looks like he's got this little tiny, like Batman has skipped leg day way too many times. Yeah, you're right.
He's got skinny little legs.
He's got skinny chicken legs.
And then here's what you've been waiting for. Pam kisses him, and we get trippy, you know, euphoria, psychedelic scene. And yeah, she actually strips down, and we just see her, like, all in black with her hair like a crazy plant vine creeping thing.
Yeah, yeah. And her look on when she's floating over top of Batman when she says Titiana, the queen of the May, and you are my winged fairy king. She looks, Poison Ivy in the comics in a few years will look like this all the time. You know, there's just some versions of her, that's like Alex Ross.
Yeah, what I was thinking. Like I was wondering if this is the first time we see her like this, because this will be a signature look for her for a little while in a particular era.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, with the whited out skin, like the white skin will become a thing for her.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like, you know, she's got green skin here, which will become a thing. She's got really white, pale skin, which will become a thing. Different looks for her over the years, and, you know, just enough leaves to cover her bits, you know, her naughty bits. Yeah.
I mean, she straddles Batman on the next page, and she's not wearing much clothes. There's definitely a sexual aspect of this kind of attack, and then she's removing his mask, you know, he's like struggling and saying no, so there is a sexual assault aspect of this scene. It's a little bit weird, and I like that because of Ivy and who she is and what she represents. I like that she is violating him in a pseudo-sexual way that we associate with rape. And the fact that it's Ivy of all characters, I think she can get away with that. I mean, nobody should get away with it. We're talking about rape, whether it's male or female, it doesn't matter. It's awful.
Yeah.
But within the context of this story, if you're going to have a villainous character do this, I think it makes sense for Ivy because of what she represents in terms of sexuality and objects of desire versus like the rose with an actual thorn and the poison of it all. It's a really cool aspect and reversal of power in this scene that I like.
Yeah.
And it's like the last part of the issue I actually do like.
Okay.
Yeah, and then he kicks the sprinkler system, which floods the greenhouse, hurting like her plants that need to be dry, succulents or something like that. And just like the last image of like the sort of psychedelic thing, it's like something that almost like a wave of something is crashing over her and like going to drown it. So
yeah, yeah, and it kind of makes you wonder though: did Bruce Wayne not take a shower during all this storyline, because you know the water snaps him out of it here, but it didn't, you know, and he was away from her then. So it's like, does Batman stink? Does he not take a shower every once in a while? You know, maybe this is way colder. He needed to take a cold shower. You know,
perhaps. Yeah. Yeah, she just changes all of a sudden. She's like, "Don't leave me," and she's like, "I won't go back to the hospital." And she picks up the gun and she's screaming, "I'm not crazy, I'm not." And it's like, okay, now she sounds just like Batman when he was lashing out at Gordon. Like,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, and her bullet looks so tiny coming out of that gun. It's so weird looking.
Right, right.
It's like, wow, okay, it's a tiny little bullet.
It's It's a pellet gun.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like you shot with a BB. You'll shoot your eye out, kid. Yeah.
It turns into sort of the most kind of cliche dialogue of like, you're trying to ruin my life. You're trying to confuse me.
Hey, at least her outfit is also very 90s because she's got a black midi skirt with tights. She looks like Lisa Loeb from the Stay video.
Yeah, actually, there you go. Another 90s.
Yeah, which
I'm going to have a hell of a time picking out a song at the end of this episode.
Oh, no, you got so much to you know, and Lisa Loeb, like, I was like, you know, she's a cute brunette with glasses, and, you know, that was my thing. That's why I married one, so, you know.
Oh, she's adorable in that video. I still listen to that song a lot.
It's a great song. Yeah, she's great. Yeah.
She's amazing. Yeah, and then she, like, almost... Is she going to jump? Is she tripping?
Yeah, I don't know. It's like, is she... Because she steps back and it's like she drops the gun. And I can't tell if she's like ready to trying to kill herself or she just doesn't care. She's just like, you know, if I die, I die. It's like it's definitely kind of, you know, she doesn't jump forward off. But, yeah, of course, Batman grabs her. And I like the silhouette of on the next page framed with the blood dripping on the leaves of the ivy. That's in her shoe dropping. That's a nice little touch. And she's very curvy. I like that. She's very, you know, she's not, you know, a stick figure or anything. She's got a lot of curves, which is nice silhouette.
I do have to ask though, because like the danger here is her falling to her death, not unlike Ian Spencer that we saw at the beginning of this two-parter and Batman couldn't save him. So there's a parallel here. We're coming back to that. But the page before that with like 16 panels or something like that. It's a ton. The one dead set in the middle where he's chasing her up the stairs. How tall is this goddamn greenhouse? Like how many stairs are there in this thing?
I mean, this is like a blimp hangar that's been converted into a greenhouse or something. Yeah.
This is like the number of stairs in Gotham Cathedral in the movie. Like just going up and up and up. Like,
yeah.
What kind of plants do you have in here?
I think it's funny, too, that Pamela's hair is all down from the water in the first few panels, but I guess they run up so many flights of stairs it's gotten dried and back to it bounces back to her curl. She's using one. It's an all botanical conditioner she uses, of course. Or maybe not, because she wouldn't do that to a plant, right? So maybe not.
Yeah, well, yeah, not
yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And then back at the A version of Arkham Asylum, which looks very... I don't know, almost European villa, like a...
Yeah.
This looks like almost like a castle or monastery in, like, Siena or somewhere in Italy or something.
Right. I mean, it looks like a nice place, not a beautiful, like, tourist attraction, not the hell on earth that Arkham Asylum is normally shown to be.
Especially because it looks like her cell is, like, partially underground, like the hill, like she can reach out and grab the flowers from where she is and... She's plucking the petals. He loves me not. And then whispers, you know, he loves me to the passing nurse. And then she said, like, has like this. Now she's like gone childlike in this weird kind of catatonic state. And then doing that little whistling, or maybe you're right, but like the last part, maybe that is how she talks to the plants. I mean, they say plants respond to music. So is she doing a kind of song or whistle to them? So,
yeah. Yeah, and she looks like Little Orphan Annie on the last
that's...
I mean, he's drawn her with those eyes, several characters with just dots for eyes, but circles. But here, that last panel in particular, it's like, you know, where's Sandy in the background? You know?
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Like, I wonder if this was... This ending was John Francis Moore's idea, or if this was something editorial wanted to kind of make her this kind of lovesick character, because it feels like a departure that we didn't have enough of a build up to this motivation for her or this kind of crazy. We also, the story with Dominique Alioso just gets dropped. We never see her again.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Other than Victor coming to kill her and then becoming her stooge. You know, that's the only time that comes back. So, yeah, that's kind of weird. Yeah. I didn't really have a problem with it until, you know, you mentioned yours. But now I can see what you're saying. It's quite, it's, it is quite a switch, but it's like, I feel like Poison Ivy's always kind of been like, you know, a blank slate for creators to reinterpret, because she's appeared enough to make a dent in the Rogues Gallery up to this point, but not enough to have an established character. I feel like the animated series, like many characters, really fleshed her out a lot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of what we know about Poison Ivy and what sprung forward is based on her portrayal in that more than the comic, because she's pretty inconsistent. I mean, she shows up in the original comic, you know, kind of like in Batman and Robin, the movie, where, you know, she basically has Batman and Robin at each other by using her, you know, pheromones to control them. And there's these other supervillainesses she's, you know, fighting for attention against. And I haven't reread it in a long time, but that's what I remember. And then she ends up being in the Injustice Gang or whatever they called it, with Libra and Kronos and Tattooed Man, who we mentioned before, and Scarecrow and those guys in the Justice League book. And, you know, she doesn't make a whole lot of appearances, really, until after the animated series and then Batman and Robin, you know, the movie. So, yeah, she's, you know, this was kind of an interesting direction, but yeah, it kind of undermines what they were setting up in a lot of ways, the ending does.
Yeah, and I mean, at some point after the animated series, they did kind of, I think they kind of found a direction with being environmental warrior / eco-terrorist, which
yeah,
I think is more sustainable than her just being targeting, you know, rich guys who abused her or CEOs who have, you know, damaged the environment. Although I don't think there's nothing wrong with painting her that way.
No.
I think that might be like one of the best ways to, like, if Matt Reeves was going to use Poison Ivy, like, I think that would probably be the most grounded take on her, is targeting people like Bruce Wayne or like the kind of wealthy, influential CEOs that she thinks is damaging the environment and destroying the world.
Yeah.
And getting revenge that way. I think that would be a more kind of human take on her, which I don't think is bad. But yeah, certainly playing with the sexuality of the character, making her bisexual and now pretty much just lesbian, I think it kind of worked, because it still has there's still the idea of like her being super sexy, super attractive. All the guys want her, but it's never going to be reciprocal. She doesn't want them. She'll only use them and only hurt them and use her sexuality to get back at them.
So, yeah, I don't know when the Batman Green Arrow Poison Tomorrow one-shot came out. I just remember that. That was by Danny O'Neill and Mike Nitzer / Nasser. It came out around this period, and that's the first time I really remember them going eco-terrorist with Poison Ivy that I remember.
I have that on a shelf about 5 feet away from me, I think.
Yeah, I don't know what year. I don't know what year that's from. It's from this era, I know.
Yes,
but
yeah.
So yeah, so she was kind of starting to coalesce into that, I think. But yeah, this is maybe a last remnant of the man eater Poison Ivy. There's a song for you.
Poison Tomorrow was before this. It was 92.
Oh, okay. Okay. So yeah, this is kind of a retrograde in a ways.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, we'll take a quick promo break, and then when we come back, we'll return to coverage of Batman and Robin Year One.
Hello there. Come on in and welcome to the Fantastic Four. I am your host, Brett Young, and this is the podcast serving up comics, cocktails, and conversation for your listening pleasure. Every episode, I'll welcome a guest to the Fantastic Lounge to explore one of their favorite comic book characters and cover a classic story in which they're featured. And what pairs better with great literature than a delicious drink? Based on my guest's ingredient of choice, we'll mix up a cocktail or mocktail to enjoy in the Fantastic Lounge while we talk comics, mixology, history, and whatever else comes to mind. So join me every month for the Fantastic Pour, open for business by the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Okay, we're back, and as we said, we're going to jump into Batman and Robin Year One, Number 5. The story was called Chapter 5. The co-plot was by Mark Waid and Chris Samnee. Writer was Mark Waid, artist Chris Samnee, colorist Matthias Lopez, letterer Clayton Cowles, with Chris Samnee, senior editor Andrew Marino and group editor Rob Levin. Bruce is furious when he is called to pick Dick up 1 hour after he was dropped off at school. Dick took umbrage to his homeroom teacher referring to the classroom as a circus. Bruce threatens to ground Robin unless Dick apologizes to his teacher tomorrow. That night, the dynamic duo answers the bat signal, but Gordon has no interest in talking to the overly bombastic Robin. Even though Gotham's crime families now know Grimaldi is escalating the tension between them, it continues to rise. Gordon has learned that Grimaldi's master of disguise, the Melting Man, may have a name, Hagen. Batman asks Gordon about the file Two-Face stole from his office, but Gordon continues to play ignorant about it. Later that night, Bruce Wayne attends the going-away party of fellow millionaire Martin Kosky, who has apparently sold his company and holdings and is heading to Europe. Bruce makes note of the tattoo on his wrist. Meanwhile, at Wayne Manor, Dick grows bored and borrows, quote-unquote, a bat cycle, unauthorized. After the party, Batman observes Kosky, knowing from his demeanor and the tattoo that the real Martin had removed a week ago, that this is Hagen in disguise. The real Martin Kosky is dead in his closet. When Batman confronts the imposter, he puts on a blank theatrical face mask. Alfred sends an emergency signal to the Caped Crusader about Robin's AWOL status, but Batman is occupied avoiding shots fired by Hagen. Robin, meanwhile, is observed by Grimaldi's men, who make plans for him. At Kosky's home, Batman snags Hagen's leg with a bat rope and is shocked when it is sliced off. The usually unflappable Dark Knight is even more spooked when Hagen reabsorbs it, then begins to melt it into an overflow of clay as Batman grabs him. Robin stops what he thinks is a mugging, only to find out it's an ambush by Grimaldi's men. He holds his own for a while, but is overpowered and knocked unconscious. Hagen is drowning Batman in a puddle of clay, but the masked manhunter pulls on his bat rope and literally splits Hagen in half. While Batman coughs up the clay he swallowed, Hagen manages to escape. The Dark Knight detective finally takes Alfred's call and learns Robin is missing. The boy wonder awakens bound in the office of General Grimaldi. The crime boss tells him he never harms children, but he's not above using them as bait. So what do you think of this one, Ryan? Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you
down, never gonna run around and desert you. I love this issue, really love it. It's funny, there's some great bits, you know, between the tension between Bruce and Dick is growing at an appropriate pace, and it's going to lead to a new kind of danger for the two of them when they're working alone. And I think that's going to be fun to kind of explore in this one. But also, we've been waiting for Clayface, well, a proper Clayface, for a while now. And we're finally seeing him, and I like this. This is really fun.
Now, I do have one thing. The cover by Samnee is well illustrated, and it shows Batman like reaching out through what seems to be like a sewer grate, and Clayface is like, half of Clayface's face is on the other side of Batman's face, and he's like covered in this clay. But then you also see another hand, which is apparently Batman's hand, reaching out. So is this Clayface mocking Batman by turning into him, or is this a mirror reflection? Because we do see mirrors in the scene where he confronts Clayface. I'm having a little trouble figuring out what I'm looking at, despite it being very well done.
Yeah, the other hand, the hand in the foreground that's reaching towards Batman, maybe just because it's colored slightly different. My first thought when I saw it was it's Robin's hand.
Mm.
But maybe it doesn't. Maybe it looks too big to be Robin's hand. Like, hard to tell. Yeah, like if it is Clayface's hand, then it's a little bit confusing. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you just cover that part of the cover, I love it. I love everything about the cover.
Me too. Yeah. Yeah. It's a fantastic cover. It's just that hand throws me. So, I don't know. But now, getting into the story, we know what happened after Alfred dropped Dick off at school.
Right after.
Right after. 1 hour later. As the SpongeBob cartoon would say, 1 hour later. You know. Yeah, and then we get one of the greatest lines in any Batman comic ever when Bruce says, "I managed to wane the principal into keeping your tantrum off the record this one time." And Alfred later whispers, "Sir, did you just use wane as a verb?"
I love it because I caught that as soon as I read that. I'm like, oh, he's using wane as a verb. I was like, that's interesting. And then when Alfred brings it up, I was like, okay, Mark Waid was really proud of himself for coming up with that line. So much so that he's like, I've got to let the readers know that that was a really clever thing that I just did. I've got to draw extra attention to this part because I'm so smart. And I'm like, all right, Mark Waid, you're allowed that one. You can take it out because that was good.
Yeah, that was good. I kind of like it though because it kind of does work with Batman using the fake Bruce Wayne as a tool. You know, it's an arsenal in his weapon.
It's a weapon
in his arsenal. I said that backwards.
Right.
That he uses as Batman. He uses Bruce Wayne as the socialite to as a means to an end to Batman. So, you know, he literally waned his way out of this problem, just like he'd use a lockpick to break out of a trap. He's using Bruce Wayne to get Dick out of this. So I like that Dick argues if he isn't going to school, he'll have more time for crime fighting. Does he really think he's going to get out of this? I mean, it seems like he does.
He's singularly focused on the Robin aspect and not the Dick Grayson aspect. And I think that is something that Bruce has had a hard time drilling into him, that you have to have both of these. And maybe it's because Bruce always kind of takes that for granted. And that's one of the things that Alfred said. It's like, this kid needs to be a kid part of his life. And that means, you know, part of that you have to be a dad for part of your life, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do like the reason he got mad was the teacher referred to her class as a circus. And Dick says, she said it like a slur. Was I supposed to sit there and take it? And Bruce says, circus is an observation. It's not a slur. Says the man who never lived in one. It's just like, you know, it's like he like actually got offended by that. I think he actually did. I don't think he just did it to get out of school early. I think he, you know, he's a little bit of a hothead and he's like, hey man, don't be thrown off on the circus, you know?
Right. But exactly how hard did he push back on her saying that he got kicked out of school?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, did he cuss her out or something? I mean, geez.
Something.
Then we get the scene with the answer to the bat signal. And I like that Gordon, there's this little scene where Gordon's like, take your time. You're not the only one out to catch criminals, you know. And then they show up. And Robin's really laying it on thick here. I mean, he's like, don't despair, Commissionaire. Robin and Batman to the rescue. Clue solved. Crime wave stopped. And I love how Gordon's just like, you see an R on this thing?
And I like that, like Gordon, after their last conversation, like back in issue one or something, like Gordon is tolerating this only so much. You can tell he's still not happy about the kid's presence there. Like, okay, I will talk to Batman about this. I'm not talking to Robin as if I condone this.
Yeah, it's like, you know, yeah, he's barely tolerating. And I like that they keep that going. You know, I don't know if I can't, you know, I don't want to, I've read the series, but I haven't reread it to, you know if we get someplace different with those two by the end of this or not. But even if we don't, you know, you can assume that at some point he gets to be where he's semi-okay, you know, with it, I guess. But, I love that. Yeah. So we learned that the Melting Man has a name, Hagen, which of course is the classic name of the second Clayface, Matt Hagen. And that the file Two-Face stole resurfaces, but Gordon is playing very coy about it, and Batman isn't happy. So I like that we've got this tension, you know, between Batman and Gordon here. That's a nice, another little touch, and it's kind of interesting because as Batman takes Robin on as a partner, his partnership with Gordon is being strained by not only having Robin, but by this aspect as well.
Right, right. And he's like, Gordon has never necessarily kept secrets from him before, so something about this is different. And yeah, I like that different. And again, we kind of were reminded because that folder will play a part in a few issues later down the road. So they have to kind of keep resurfacing that and keep bringing them. And yeah, the tension, the wedge it drives between them is good for the sake of drama.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like in this series, we see a lot of Bruce Wayne because we see the real Bruce Wayne with Dick and Alfred, but we also see the fake Bruce Wayne that I was mentioning earlier at Martin Kosky's party. And I like that. And he's, of course, using Bruce to, you know, schmooze with the public and see what's going on. And I like that he's still, of course, playing detective while he's there. He notices this tattoo on Martin's wrist, which, what is that? Is it like a, is it a martini glass or what's it supposed to be? I don't know. What am I looking at?
I do not know.
I don't either. It looks kind of like a martini glass with a lampshade coming out of it. I don't know what it is. But yeah, but, you know, we don't know where they're going with this Martin thing, but it's a nice little setup. Well, you know, and I like the colors here. Everything's in these warm, you know, well-lit colors where, you know, most of the stuff with Batman and Robin's all in, you know, blues and grays. And it's, you know, kind of, again, the colorist is doing a fantastic job here. And that colorist is Matthias Lopez. So good on them.
And I really like the final panel. Martin goes off to his thing. And after Batman noticed the tattoo, or Bruce noticed the tattoo, and we see him now, he's isolated. He's all alone. And we just kind of get him framed by the other party goers who we don't see their faces. So it's really just him isolated. And the colors of all of their outfits are darker. So to contrast with him in the light and everything else dark. And just very small dialogue, just like, we'll do Martin, but Martin is in quotation marks. So, you know, he knows this isn't the right one.
Right. And I like, you know, this is kind of similar to what you said in the previous story where Batman's legs make a figure. There's a woman on the right-hand side of the panel in the last panel with Martin, second to the last panel, and then a woman in the left-hand panel.
Yeah.
And it's they're two different women. They got two different colored dresses, but it kind of, you know,
creates the hourglass figure of them. Yeah.
Yeah. And it creates an hourglass. And also it just shows how Bruce is disappearing into the crowd at this point, you know, and it's almost like he's receding into the background so he can go become Batman. So, yeah. And then, you know, then Dick pulls something that we keep referencing the Schumacher movies a lot, but he basically pulls a Chris O'Donnell. Instead of stealing the Batmobile, he steals a bat cycle. So,
yeah.
Or bat bike, as Alfred calls it, which I don't like. It's like, it's a bat cycle, Alfred. Call it by its name, you know. I like the look of it, though. It reminds me of, like, equal parts 40s Batmobile, Art Deco, BTAS look for the Bat Cycles, and the coloring of the Brave and the Bold animated series. So,
yeah. I see. Yeah,
good. Yeah. It's a sharp looking Bat Cycle. I would buy a toy of this if someone
hint Mattel, if you're listening.
Yeah. Yes, hint. I like the caption. We get the next page where Batman's keeping an eye on, now he's Batman, keeping an eye on Martin, quote unquote. And we get where Batman says the tattoo tipped him off that this wasn't Martin Kosky, but the fact that he's scowling cinched it because Martin cons himself by staying chipper all the time. So he would normally be grinning himself, you know, to himself after they left just because he is very insecure and he likes to, you know, fool himself into thinking everyone likes him and everything's fine. So, and then we see Martin's dead body with a noose around it. So it's like around his neck. So it's like, did he hang him? Did he, at some point, are they going to make it look like Martin hung himself? I don't think they really need to do that, but maybe that will explain. Maybe they'll take that body somewhere in Europe and leave him hanging from somewhere. And I don't, what did you think about that? Or is that just,
I wasn't even thinking, I mean, yeah, it would make sense if they eventually need to kind of like end this charade, if they kind of pose his death as a suicide or something like that. But yeah, it just seemed kind of like more of a grisly way to kill him and everything, just like different than just like shooting him or stabbing him. But like just, yeah, to choke him out with a noose or a rope like that is just, yeah.
Yeah, awful. Yeah. And then we, at the panel where Hagen's looking in the closet at him as his face changes, he kind of looks like Two-Face right there, which is interesting, you know, because he's...
He does, but I also thought of the Batman the animated series with the little girl on the L train going, ew, mommy, she's melting.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did such great things with Clayface on there. Wow, yeah. I like that he's got this like clay-like, you know, dramatic, like, acting mask. It looks, it's a nice callback to the Basil Carlo Clayface in a way. I like that. Yeah. It's a nice touch. Yeah. Did you catch the Easter egg on the page where we first see Robin on the bat cycle? It's like the second panel after Alfred's scream.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a fire escape with a little girl, perhaps a young prostitute or girl or street girl, sitting looking at Robin. And also on the fire escape are numerous cats. And inside the room, all pink, is a woman dressed up in very tight black pants and a tight. It's Selena Kyle. It's our year one Selena.
And Holly, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, and Holly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They're sex workers. We don't want to say exactly what they are because we don't want to get into all that again. But yeah,
right. No judgment.
No judgment. This is definitely the when I was looking at it, reading, I'm like, oh, nice. They don't say anything about it. He doesn't even notice them. It's just a nice little Easter egg. I wonder if Mark Waid even put that in the script or Chris Samney just decided to draw it that way. It'd be interesting to know who come up with that. So
sure, yeah.
Yeah, and then, of course, we got Grimaldi's men who note Robin is out there. And the one guy says, call for backup. And he said, ain't we enough? He's just a kid. And he said, you ain't seen him move. I have. Call. And his face is all bandaged up from the last time he had a run-in with Robin, which is
nice. Yeah, that's a nice reveal that the guy's got bandages all over his face. And he's like, yeah, I've seen that kid in action.
Yeah. Yeah. And Batman, evades bullets that are being fired at him by Hagen from the mirrored doors of the closet in Martin Kosky's house. And then we get this great sequence where he's running from Batman down the stairs and Batman throws the batarang and bat rope and pulls. And the usually unflappable Batman starts to get a little, what the hell? Because he pulls his foot off. He like slices his foot and part of his leg off.
And he's like, prosthetic? And he's like, it has to be, right? And then Kagan starts running up the stairs again back at him with what appear to be both legs. Or then he kind of like steps on his fake leg and it kind of reseals it.
Yeah, he reabsorbs his leg.
Yeah.
And then the next page where he's, he's got him up by the throat and he says, you're done, Hagen. I'm not letting go. And then the clay just starts to ooze out of that mask and just pour all over Batman. And I didn't notice it the first time, but Batman's arm goes through his neck.
Yeah, and it's all
coming out the other side. Yeah,
yes.
It's coming out the other side. That panel where he is starting to melt and it's coming out of his eyes, that almost looks Breyfogle-esque from the Mud Pack.
Ooh, yeah, I can see. Yep, definitely good catch there. I love it. It's a great panel. Like, this whole sequence, this whole page is amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, it really brings the horror of Clayface without, going to the giant, monstrous, lawn cigar, as Bullock said, version from the animated series. I mean, it's he's scary. I mean, just the idea that you can't touch this guy and he can just ooze this all over you is just, it's pretty much, bodes well for this movie they're making, I guess. So.
And Batman's having to reassess. He's like, wait, he's melting. Wait, he's not melting. It's not even warm. He's like, this feels more like clay. And then like the whole, I'm also like trying to think about the timeline or what exactly continuity that we're in. And I'm wondering, like, is this the first like meta human that this Batman has had to face? Like the first person like with like legit superpowers in his rogues gallery that in this particular timeline?
Yeah. Well, I kind of got that impression that it was that he's not used to dealing with superpowered foes. They're all nuts, but they've not been extra normal at this point, So then we get to Robin, back to Robin. This issue is going back and forth between Batman and Robin. And I struggled with, do I just go ahead and recap the Robin part separate from Batman? I'm like, nah, I'll go back and forth. But, Robin stops what he thinks is a mugging, but it's actually the two Grimaldi men setting him up. And, he's being all, of course, his smart ass self. And at first he's leaping around him and making short work of him. And even when more guys come running in, you know, the one guy, he leaps out of the way and one goon hits his own gang member with a bat. And, you know, and he says, you know, I mean, how many made men does it take to bring down one adorably two-fisted kid? 100? 1,000? And some guy says, 1, and grabs him by the cape. And you know, but then Robin, he does manage to get away there. There's some shots fired, but he says, in a fair fight, you'd all be. And then the guy with the bat finally whacks him in the head. So, yeah, it, again, you know, we've brought this up on the Fire and Water Network many times. All our heroes would have so much brain damage. How many times they have been knocked, you know, in unconscious. They've all had, you know, contusions and you know, they'd really be in bad shape. Yeah. So
Robin swinging into action in these pages on like both pages or all three pages of the fight, really, these are Daredevil or Spider-Man poses that Samnee is repurposing for Robin, which works. It works perfectly for Robin and Daredevil to kind of fight the same way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just love it. Like from the first one, when he's leaping, when he's first kind of, when he still thinks that it's a mugging thing and the way he kind of has both of his knees bent as he's leaping up with his finger splayed, I'm like, I've seen Daredevil and Spider-Man like that. And then the next page, when he's kicking with both legs straight out, it's, yeah, these are good stuff.
Yeah, I love the coloring too. Again, it just looks really, it's really sharp. I love how they, you know, they I like it when they give Robin a like a kind of more of a gold cape than yellow, mm-hmm. and he's against a yellow background here, so I like that. Yeah, like you said, it very much feels like I like to see Robin get in a hallway fight. You know, since we're doing Daredevil here, you know, Netflix Daredevil. Yeah. Yeah, it's a great sequence. And also a great sequence and one of the best in this comic so series so far is when Batman, you know, Clayface has Batman down, or Hagen, I guess I should call him. And all you see is just the Batman's caption, Clay, throat, line, where, the line, pull. You know, and it just shows like a close-up of Batman finding the line and Hagen's face and Batman's eye and then Batman pulling. And I love that last panel because you see a split mm-hmm. in the mask on Hagen. And then in the next page, what do we got?
Ooh, Hagen be split in half. Just like, it's perfect. Like, you know, Wade must have been thinking of really thinking about this, but like maybe he took a class or something. But yeah, like people sculptor, when they work with clay, kids in art classes, they use those wires. They use wires to cut clay and to split it and everything like that. And that's what he's doing with the bat line. And it's perfect. Just splits him down the middle. And like, oh, Batman, like you must have been really confident that this wouldn't kill him for good.
Right. Yeah. Or at this point, maybe he didn't
care.
Or
just desperate enough.
Yeah, he's desperate. He's going to die. He's like, when I'm going to die, I'll take him out if I have to. You know, which I don't have any problem with that.
I won't be killed by gardening shears, and I won't be killed by clay.
Right. Yeah, and it's such a, like you said, it took me immediately back to art class, you know, where you took, like you said, the wires. And it's, and I like that Batman, you know, he has to spend some amount of time barfing up all this clay in his throat.
Yeah.
And you see Hagen ooze away and, you know, he's gone, which, you know, but I like that Batman, even after all that, it's like, but I hope it sunk in deep. Even he couldn't kill the Batman. So yeah, I feel like this is probably his first encounter with a meta human of some kind, you know? So yeah. And then he finally takes Alfred's call, and I like that Alfred is Penny One, yeah. You know, Penny One to Batman, but you know, which maybe is a little too on the nose. If somebody suspects Bruce Wayne's Batman, and everybody knows his butler's Alfred Pennyworth, you might want to come up with a different, you know, code name.
Call Money Penny.
Yeah, Money Penny. There you go. Money Penny. Yes. Yeah. And then, you know, Alfred tells him the boy's gone, and of course we were back in Grimaldi's office with, which always has the, you know, cool backlit blinds. You know, he's got Robin and he says, and his father is sitting there in the wheelchair, which is, you know, there's his father again, which is kind of interesting because the whole father and son aspect with Batman and Robin. And, you know, so that's a nice, a lot of fathers and son thing going on in this storyline, and Bruce and Alfred, of course. He says, "Robin, I have good news for you. I don't hurt children, but I have no problem baiting a hook with them." So that shows you that, you know, Robin's not in immediate danger, but Batman is. But it's like, you know, I don't know if we haven't got there yet. It's like, is Grimaldi, why hasn't he unmasked him yet? And I'm sure we'll, you know, maybe they'll address that next issue. Maybe they won't, because sometimes comic stories just don't bother with addressing why they don't immediately unmask the hero when they have him caught, you know. But, you know, how many death traps did Batman and Robin get in on the TV show? And very few times did anybody ever try to unmask him. So, you know.
One of the Austin Powers movies, when Dr. Evilix leaves Austin Powers in a death trap. And he's like, "All right, I'm going to go over here now." He's like, "Why don't we just kill him right now?" He's like, no. I've put him in a death trap, and now I'm going to go do other things and turn my back, and I'll just assume that he'll die. And if you say, I'll assume that the death trap is... It's like, you could shoot him right now, and there's no doubt about it. He's like, "Son, you're not listening."
Yeah, "I've got a gun in my room, Dad." Yeah, that's okay.
We can kill him together. Yeah. Like,
Scott Evil, it's yeah.
Like, you just have to manufacture a reason to not do the obvious thing, but yeah.
So overall, what are your final thoughts as we wrap this one up?
I like this one a lot. The stuff with Robin fighting on his own is cool, because you see how formidable he is, but also still a kid.
Yeah.
Still going to be overwhelmed by these bruisers in a fight. And you also get a little bit like his last words before being knocked unconscious are, you know, "You guys aren't fighting fair." It's like, you're the child who threw himself into this. Like, what were you expecting? How much did you think you could get away with? But overall, I love finally seeing Batman fighting Clayface, and in this case, fighting him for the first time, and how he reacts to that. And yeah, like the look of Hagen wearing that clay mask and everything it's cool, it's creepy, and he's a scary threat that, yeah, it's really, really exciting. Continues to be so. Great series.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, and I really like their portrayal of Robin here, but he's being a little overly cocky, which of course he is. Like you said, he's a kid, but he kind of had this one coming. So yeah, he's got his butt in a sling now for a reason. So, you know, I'm sure Batman ain't going to be real happy with him, but when he, because we obviously know they survived this, but, you know, it'll be interesting the conversations they have after this. So yeah. So we got anything we want to talk about before we take off?
Well, this was Batman Nightcast episode 49, which, if you know your numbers, means the next one is episode 50. A big milestone episode deserves a big milestone issue to cover. Do we want to tease them with what we're going to talk about next episode?
Well, I mean, I think we're burying the lead if we say it's not the greatest Batman story ever told.
And he's not just talking about Batman and Robin year one, issue 6. There's another one.
No, we're going to do that one, but we're going to do another one. And yes, you can argue with me about that being that one, but it's definitely in contention whether you put it at the tip top or not. It's definitely deserving of that title, I think. So
we'll leave it at that, but long-term listeners of this podcast and the Fire and Water Network, if you know Chris Franklin, you should know what he's talking about.
That's right. That's right. Okay, well, I think I will see if I can Franklin the outro here. Batman Nightcast is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for the show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also find Batman Nightcast and the Fire and Water Network on Facebook, Blue Sky, and other social media platforms.
If you enjoyed this episode, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast to support Batman Nightcast or your other favorite shows on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. And by the way, I just remembered, shout out to J. David Weeder, who is now a patron of this podcast. Meant to add that in the notes at the beginning of the episode, but I got it in under the wire. Thank you, J. David Weeder, for supporting Batman Nightcast.
Yes, thank you, J. David. We really appreciate your support. And as always, thank you all for listening.
deserve.